The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I would suspect that most listeners have heard of Irvine, California, down in Orange County, around Los Angeles. It is named after James Irvine, who also founded the James Irvine Foundation, one of the most important and highly respected foundations in all of California. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their president and CEO, Don Howard. Good evening, Don, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Tell us who James Irvine was and some of the history of the foundation that bears his name.
Well, Mr. Irvine was an agricultural pioneer. He owned at the time about 20% of present-day Orange County, turned that from grazing land into agriculturally productive land, innovated on irrigation and brought in some new crops, and was a very successful man of the land in his time. Near to his death, he decided to put a little more than half of his holdings into a foundation to benefit the state of California. We're still giving that money away today. It's now valued at our corpus is about $2.5 billion, and we have the privilege of giving away about $100 million a year right now.
Yeah, started about $5 million or something like that, so it has really, really grown.
Well, I can tell you, if we held on to the land, we probably would be a much larger foundation as well.
Yeah, he kind of went from agriculture to real estate as California took off, but as you said, if he held it a little bit longer, who knows where it would be.
You know, one thing to know about the foundation that's distinctive is we're an independent foundation. Mm-hmm. No family members involved at this point, no corporate interests involved at this point. Our governance is a board of 13 of us who represent the state in various and diverse ways. And we have a focus on a single state, California, which granted at 40 million is a lot of folk. But on the other hand, it gives us at least a running shot at having a strategy.
Yeah.
So Mr. Irvine, in addition to giving us these resources, gave us a focus on a state and a lot of latitude to how we went about our grant making. We're the only independent foundation in California with the state as a focus without having some overlay of health in particular.
That's a nice niche. Well, let's talk about that state for a moment. The economy of California has been on a tear. It is now the fifth largest economy in the world, and it was only 5 years or so ago that it was as low as 10th. Yet, one in five Californians lives in poverty, which is significantly higher than the one in seven average for the rest of the country, and it has the highest child poverty in the nation at 22.8%. Why is that the case?
California is really two states. We have a state with quite a bit of affluence and folks who are successful and driving the economy. And then we have a part of our state, particularly in the inland portions of California, that is really being left behind. It's not lost on me. I live in San Francisco, that I can drive 2 hours from 3 hours from my home to Fresno. And in one place, you know, the average home price is approaching $1 million. Another, you have homes that are in the $200,000 and $300,000 range. The disparities are acute and they're present and they're very much in our face.
Mm-hmm. Well, many experts agree that what happens in California often foreshadows what's going to happen for the rest of the country in the years ahead. And I know when you started your tenure here, Don, you traveled around the state listening to people and their concerns, one community after another. And I assume you're still listening. What did you hear? What did you learn?
Let me tell you, just to back quickly to your question about what's going on in California, important to know that in addition to being the highest poverty state in the union, we have the two poorest congressional districts in the United States. Fresno, in particular, is the poorest. And this is one example of the kind of communities that are under-resourced and are being left out of the economic explosion.
Mm-hmm.
That listening tour you mentioned, I spent time early on in my role as CEO traveling around the state, talking to leaders in different communities up and down from different sectors, asking them what they thought we should focus on at Irvine in the next generation. And to a one, they pointed to a couple of important issues, the first being this economic disparity and the haves and the have-nots, the how that goes against our values as a state, our values as a country, and importantly, what that leads to in terms of an unsustainable economy. It's just not a sustainable situation to have 4 in 10 Californians who are living in or on the brink of poverty. Mm. Those are the estimates we use. 40% of the state cycles in and out of poverty over time, and that's not a sustainable situation. The other thing I heard, which we've also taken up as a goal, is that folks are being left behind politically, that the power imbalance in our state represents what's going on in the rest of the country, and those folks who are working 2 and 3 jobs, who are being paid minimum wage and struggling to get ahead, who can't get on a pathway to the middle class, folks, they're feeling disconnected and disaffected. They're not voting and they're not involved. And it shows. We have leadership, political leadership in particular, in communities around the state that just does not represent the people of California.
Yeah. And they feel trapped, don't they?
They do. Many folks reported this. We did another series of listening events where we talked to low-wage workers across the state, and 500 or so in multiple languages over a course of 10 or 11 different sites. And what we heard time and again from them was a sense of being trapped, being on a hamster wheel, not being able to get ahead, a sense of not being connected to their community and not having the time to connect to their community, sort of being on their own, and just a tremendous amount of anxiety. If you think about the worry budget of a low-wage person and you think about the economic insecurity, and you think for many of our low-wage Californians are immigrants, often new immigrants, and there's insecurity in their status and in their families. And then there's an overlay of often young families and kids and the insecurity of the future for their children. In those listening sessions, we ask folks in various ways to depict their aspirations for their lives. And time and again, it was just so consistent. We had folks draw pictures. We had folks use words. We had folks tell stories. Folks want what all of us want for our families. We want a house. We want security, physical security, food security, economic security. We want a chance for our children to do better than we did. And often for folks, that means college. I sat in one session with Chinese immigrants in San Francisco, often working in the hotel and restaurant trade. And even though they weren't speaking in English to me, they were drawing pictures. And they were drawing pictures of picket fences, homes, kids in college, holding degrees. The aspiration to get into the middle class is as strong or stronger now than it's ever been. Unfortunately, as we all know from the data, odds are no longer in your favor that your kids will do better than you. And that's what we've taken up as our goal.
That's right. Well, let's talk about a couple of things you've done in that regard. In California, like the rest of the country, there's this huge middle-skilled job gap, well-paying jobs that sit there because employers just can't find qualified candidates. And in California, that number is staggering. It's 1.4 million jobs. So you're now looking to make an impact there. What specifically are you doing?
Yeah, so we've set as one of our overarching goals, we have two of them. One of them is enabling folks to have greater economic opportunity and get in and stay in the middle class. And what we've been doing there is looking at evidence-based efforts, evidence-based programs that can bring folks, skill up folks, and help them be prepared and placed into these middle-skilled jobs. So we're looking at programs that deliver more than a high school degree, typically less than a baccalaureate degree, and are training folks for professions that have family-sustaining wages and a pathway to a real career. So think of organizations like Year Up, working with disconnected youth, or the Center for Employment Opportunities, working with folks coming out of the justice system. Those organizations have evidence that they can make a difference. And what we've done is we've asked them to tell us, what do you need to scale up your impact? Tell us how much more you could do and what it would cost. And we've been making flexible general operating support investments over longer periods of time to help them achieve their goals on their terms. And that's been an important part. That's called our Better Careers Initiative, and that's been one of our new flagship initiatives we've launched. Our board committed $120 million over 6 years in order to help that group of organizations step up their game. And hopefully in the process of doing that, we're going to take our cue from them on how we can invest in things like research, strategic communications, evaluation, maybe policy change, built on what they know from their perch as leaders in the community to help drive systems change that go beyond the direct impact of their work.
Let me pick up on something you just said there, and that's strategic communications. Do employers communicate clearly the kind of skills they need, or is that a gap that exists?
You know, I've just recently spent time making the rounds talking to the largest employers of middle-skilled staffers across the state. Think PG&E, Chevron, Salesforce, UPS, AT&T, and Kaiser as another example. I've been so impressed by the recognition they have that the current situation is not sustainable. They have great needs for hiring. They can't meet those needs with the traditional education systems, and they are no longer or never were built up to provide that kind of training internally. So what I hear from them is they have really a moving target with jobs. Take Kaiser as an example. Yep. One thing I was really impressed, they are conceptualizing a new job that is a paraprofessional focused on mental health. They are overrun in terms of the need to supply mental health services. They know that that's that's important for health prevention and health advancement for their members, and they can't find enough MSWs and MFTs to do the mental health work. And no one, not everyone's going to get a 50-minute appointment with a skilled professional. So they're conceptualizing of a new role, and they're thinking about how they can partner with nonprofits and community colleges to design that role, to credential that mm-hmm. role, to recruit those folks, and to get them onboarded.
That's great. Another huge cohort in the state are the 5 million Californians making less than $14 an hour, and many of them are making less than $10 an hour. Now, your efforts here are around something you call the Fair Work Initiative. What are the issues, and what is your strategy?
Yeah, so in addition to not having jobs that pay sufficient wages, we have a considerable number of folks who have jobs, low-paying jobs, but are often not getting to take home the wages they've earned. We believe every Californian should take home the wages they've earned, and unfortunately, there's about 600,000 Californians who are losing, the estimate is, an average of $3,400 each to wage theft every year.
Hmm.
So the total wage theft in the state is estimated at $2 billion. It falls disproportionately on the 600,000 minimum wage workers, and the average per worker is $3,400.
Oh, wow.
So you're not only are you working a job that pays, the average wage here was $12.50 an hour, you might be working multiple jobs, and you're losing, through wage theft, $3,000 plus.
Give us an example of wage theft.
So wage theft, take, for example, a restaurant worker who might be encouraged to work through their break time, or who might be not paid for their break time, or who might not receive their lunch hour, or who might work more than 40 hours but not receive overtime. If you take an agricultural worker in the fields who might be transported from one work site to the next but not paid for the time they're in transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Often this sort of wage theft is happening in, I think sadly, small, medium-sized businesses who are keeping themselves afloat by, in essence, subsidizing their economics by not paying their workers what they're due. And oftentimes that's immigrant-on-immigrant wage theft, which adds another complication culturally and linguistically. Many of the folks who are losing their wages are not likely to want to go into a public office and complain, so they sort of suffer in the shadows and
want to keep their job.
Right. The what we call our Fair Work Initiative, thanks for asking, is a $80 million initiative over 6 years. Similar construct. We've looked at the organizations that best address wage theft. They're worker centers. These are centers like the National Day Laborers Association mm-hmm. or Restaurant Opportunity Centers, National Domestic Workers Partnership, where folks are connected as workers to other workers in a culturally competent setting and can bring their wage complaints into that CBO or that nonprofit.
Right.
And that nonprofit can partner with our tremendously talented labor commissioner, Julie Sue, in California. They have a strategic partnership with these worker centers to bring wage cases forward and to bring them in a way that can strategically affect the industries in which they're brought. So one sort of great example of this was a case brought by the Chinese Progressive Association, a San Francisco-based worker center, against a dim sum chain, quite well known, called Yang Sing.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought a wage theft case into court with the labor commissioner and recouped $5 million in lost wages.
All right.
And so our goal for our Fair Work Initiative is returning $250 million a year mm-hmm. of lost wages by scaling up and strengthening the worker centers and helping invest in that partnership they have with the labor commissioner.
Fantastic. Irvine, like some other foundations, such as Ford, focus on inequality. And you alluded to a moment ago that you see a very clear connection between economic inequality and political inequality. Speak to that, and how has that informed your approach?
So we've come to appreciate that these are really two sides of the same coin. If you're a low-wage worker struggling with multiple jobs, maybe your immigration status is being challenged or is uncertain, and you're raising children, your ability to get involved civically is pretty much zero. And you might feel disaffected and disconnected and not have any motivation to be involved
mm-hmm.
Otherwise. Conversely, our economy, as much as folks might want us to believe there's such a thing as a free economy, we have an economy with policies that guide the economy. And those policies can either favor or not favor low-wage workers. And we believe more workers with civic engagement and political power will change the rules of the road and create better conditions for themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a small part of worker democracy. If I take that Yang Sing example we talked about, those workers coming forward and organizing themselves with the Chinese Progressive Association to bring this action was a very political action. And workplace democracy or workplace engagement is an on-ramp to civic engagement mm-hmm. and political involvement in our communities.
You know, bringing in this political element, as you have, is something that many foundations shy away from. As you know, they like to play it safe, don't want to rock the boat, avoid controversy if they can help it. Do you see that starting to change in the foundation community?
I do. You know, as I said before, our board is really representative of folks from across the state. And we strive to be pragmatic, solutions-oriented, and frankly, I would say cross-partisan or centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really interesting for me as the leader of the institution to watch our board's thinking on this evolve over time. As they become aware of things like the wage theft that's happening in our state, they're appalled. And they don't think of that as a partisan issue or a political issue. They think of that as fairness.
Wrong.
And,
mm-hmm.
and it's just wrong. And so to be able to invest in organizations that are helping right that wrong is a powerful motivator. I take another thread of our work and maybe lift it up, which is work we're doing around protecting immigrant rights. We've had a longstanding investment in helping communities integrate newcomers into the systems of their community. As immigration status became more challenged and as we're seeing the kind of fearfulness and divisiveness around immigrants and immigration, we've pivoted and invested now, last year I think we did $10 million to protect immigrant rights. This Know Your Rights kind of sessions, the kind of equipping folks with education to be able to protect them and their families, as well as to help beef up the policy advocates who are working in communities across the state on immigrant rights. We provided a ton of flexible support, knowing mm-hmm. that this is not a time to be prescriptive. This is a time to lean in and make those investments. And our board didn't bat an eye. In fact, they were well ahead of us. It felt to us, and I know to them, that you know, we were protecting California values, protecting our economy, protecting our community safety, and that this was the right thing to do, regardless of partisan affiliation, mm-hmm. regardless of how you think about the politics of it all.
Another way you've pivoted, Don, is with the grant making at the foundation, which has gone from a program model to an initiatives model. Explain what each is and the benefits you saw in making that change.
Yeah. So part of my mandate coming in with the board was to up our game. Mm-hmm. Had to think about how we could, by taking more risk and being more nimble, have greater impact with the resources we have, both our time and our grant making. And I, having spent a decade or so at the Bridgespan Group working for a number of foundations, had a strong point of view that an important way to do that was to eliminate program silos and try to create a single institution pursuing common goals. So one of the first things we did was, our mission's long been expanding opportunity for the people of California. We started to get specific, economic opportunity and political opportunity. And recognizing that it's a big state, we decided to focus on workers in California who are working but struggling with poverty,
mm-hmm.
focusing on California's workers who are struggling with poverty as a way to anchor our investments in economic opportunity and political opportunity. And then what we decided was rather than having programmatic silos that had some sort of eternity to them, some unending sort of dimension to them, we wanted to have initiatives with clear outcomes, a set time frame, and a dedicated source of resources that we could advance those broader goals. And in doing that, we shifted away from having individual teams based on programs, and now we have each of these initiatives has a team, cross-functional,
mm-hmm.
and folks on that team typically have half of their time dedicated to that. So they're on at least two teams. We're actually, one of our goals as we sunset and culminate some of our previous work is to get down to having folks on no more than two teams.
Okay.
It's easy to split people too much. And we, our goal is to have folks who aren't wedded to a single initiative. And I could take, like, there's a whole set of reasons to do that.
Yeah.
I think this notion of having some, you know, unanimity around what we're trying to accomplish, trying to disconnect an individual's loyalty to the institution from a loyalty to the program,
mm-hmm.
so that we can be clear-eyed about whether something's having results or not, and we can be nimble and adapt as things go. Another is to move from having content experts who are hired to design a strategy for a program to folks who are more generalists, have a lot of intellectual curiosity, and can be good at strategy development and business development, which we think is core to developing good initiatives that are able to work with grantees and collaborate. And another part of it is getting out of having a programmatic theory of change.
Okay.
One of our mantras is we're out of the answer business. The answers are in the community. Our job is to go find them and give them money. So we're trying to recognize
that
leaders in the community have the best answers.
Sure.
We're not going to conceive
people
of them.
People closest to the problem are closest to the solution.
Exactly. And so we try to configure each initiative to have a core set of grantees
mm-hmm.
that are best in class, if you will, including some earlier stage high potential grantees, particularly those that represent parts of the state that have less capacity or communities that aren't addressed by the larger nonprofits. Create that cohort, invest in each of them in the cohort scaling, and then as a cohort, get their advice and direction on how we do other investments. Mm-hmm. And hopefully build the strength of that cohort so that as our funding sunsets over time, they're a stronger, more sustainable field.
Mm-hmm. Very sound approach. You know, you just said that you were at the Bridgeman Group. You yep. were one of the preeminent consulting groups in the social sector. You were there for almost a dozen years. As a matter of fact, the Irvine Foundation was one of your clients. Is there any skill sets or experiences that you gained in your role at Bridgeman that has really served you particularly well as you lead Irvine?
Absolutely. And first, it's probably also worth noting that I was a business consultant before being a nonprofit consultant.
Right.
So we used to joke that Bridgeman, particularly in the early days, was a sort of a place for refugees from management consulting firms, and I fit the bill. My transition into the social sector was through activism around HIV mm-hmm. in the 90s, and I just couldn't go to work every day and work in things that didn't seem to matter.
Yeah.
And I was looking for some way to transition myself into the social sector, and there was Bridgeman.
There's halfway house for you.
Exactly. And it was exactly half. I mean, it's funny you say that. When folks ask what was translatable from a business consulting background and what wasn't, it's about half.
Yeah. I mean,
some of the underlying concepts, the analytic approach, organization, culture, a number of things just translate very well. Others entirely had to be remade.
Right.
The notion of setting impact goals, how to think about making trade-offs in a world with metrics, either too few metrics or metrics that aren't necessarily apples to apples,
mm-hmm.
and trying to think about imperfect capital markets. Money doesn't flow to the best ideas per se. You have to make it happen. As my colleague Tom Tierney at Bridgeman says, particularly in philanthropy, excellence is self-imposed.
Yes.
And so there's just a different set of dynamics. The one thing that I would say has been most important in my new role at Irvine is the ability to work with very diverse groups of people to come to a decision. And I hadn't appreciated just how much training I got as a consultant in bringing folks along, clarity of the challenge, using data and analytics to inform, but also bringing a group as an organism together to become more united around a common purpose. And I find I do this time and time and time again within our work at Irvine and as a leader outside of Irvine.
Yeah, that's particularly important in the social sector. You do it there more than just about anywhere else. There are so many issues that face foundations today, you know, the power imbalance between the funder and the grantee and this call for greater transparency and so many others. Is there a particular one that you really have your mind wrapped around these days?
Well, I would say, you know, it's important to remind ourselves the core business process of a foundation is allocating resources. Resources in the public benefit that go for the public good, that are intended for the public good. And so what I think about are some of the, what I've experienced as a consultant and as a leader in a foundation, the barriers to doing that well. So what we've been working hard at is creating an architecture that allows us to make trade-offs. So we see initiative relative to another initiative. How much can they advance common goals? How much do they deploy our approach, which mm-hmm. we're trying to get stronger and better at an institutional approach to our work? How do we build the roles and relationships in the institution to create the right propositions for us to make trade-offs around? So really have been focused on trying to undo the kind of pathologies of philanthropy that lead to bad decision-making
yeah.
about how to allocate resources. So that's been high on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say the second thing has been really returning the leadership, particularly around strategy and innovation, to the field. We are not social change architects as much as we might think we are and be asked to be that. We often get asked questions that are crazy. We're not the experts. The experts are in the field. And returning the rightful ownership of ideas to leaders in the social sector and to their communities and the beneficiaries they serve.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your corporate culture. Goodness knows Bridgeman had a great one, but what are you specifically doing to shape it, and what do you think makes it a special place to work?
You know, we've made this significant organizational transition over pretty much a three-year window. We had three program areas. We sunsetted all of that.
Yeah.
Turned out that there were like 10 different strands of work across the three. In doing that, we've changed roles. We've had about half the staff, a little more than half the staff, are new over
mm-hmm.
the last 3 years. And we have sort of a new process of doing our work and a new strategy. So much change has occurred. We made one of our top two priorities for the year to be strengthening our culture, binding folks together, creating common sense of purpose, and identifying sort of a new set of values that would imbue the work that we want to do going forward. And we are in the thick of it. One of the things I did recently was have lunch with every staff member
uh-huh.
to just here directly what we could be doing to strengthen our culture. We've done any number of other approaches to gathering data, and now we've put ourselves on the hook, particularly as a leadership team, to address some of the weaknesses in our culture. So we're very on it. One right now that we're working hard at is getting clearer about decision-making rights.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we have a matrix model, who gets to make which decisions? I've pushed decision-making down from a single person or a small set of folks to an executive team,
yep,
and a program management team.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to, decisions under $1 million for resource allocation get to be made by our program management team. Those are the lead program folks. So in trying to distribute leadership and decision-making more, it's become more complicated.
A little
people
bumpy.
Used to know where to go,
yeah,
right? If I told you the questions I used to get, you'd be amazed. But now at getting more clarity about who gets to make decisions and being also honest and clear with folks where input is possible, where it's not,
mm-hmm,
and if we gather input, we have to use it. So no more sort of charades about getting everyone's input and then doing whatever we already
preordained. We're going to do anyway, that's right.
So,
and no one asking you whether we can buy more pens or not either, right?
I think the question was, what should the holiday schedule be next year?
Okay.
That can't be the best use.
No. I don't know whether that's a step up or step down
decision
from pens.
Decision-making is core. Better internal communications, because mm-hmm, we have fewer natural kind of homerooms,
right,
with people on matrix teams. And we've completely revamped our talent advancement system, which may be a podcast for another day. But we've moved to a model that's much more equitable, where we have competencies for roles at different levels. Everyone with the same competence gets paid the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
No more negotiating prowess, no more who you knew, no more when you came in. It's based on clear competencies, and we're trying to develop folks to grow in those competencies. That clarity is actually unnerving. And what we're trying to do now is spend more time being clear about what it means to have that kind of a compensation system and that kind of a professional development system, particularly the role our advisors play as coaches to each of our staff members.
Yeah, well, change like that, you're always going to break a few eggs in the process, but you got to do it. It just comes with the territory.
Well, we're super committed to equity,
yeah,
internally, and
yeah,
it really is the focus of our strategy for impact as well. And I think compensation systems are the place inequity can really, unfortunately, manifest themselves quite quickly.
Yeah, that's why I'm so impressed with what Salesforce has done and what Mark Benioff has done. It's really just a great model for everyone. Let me close with this, Don. You're a fairly recent parent of twin boys, no less.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who is a parent knows how a child can change their perspective on so many things. How has your change as it relates to your work and leading the James Irvine Foundation?
I tell you, I would not have planned this when my predecessor, very wonderful leader, esteemed leader, Jim Canellis, told me he was going to transition out of the foundation. My boys were just about a year old.
Mm-hmm.
And I initially passed and said, this isn't my chance to take on the CEO role. I've got relatively newborn kids. And the thing I've learned, a couple of things. One is, first, I should do a shout-out to my boys, Boone and Grayson. And second, to say, they've made me a better leader. When I am with my boys, I am all in with them. And I have to be very present. I have to be very in their minds, which is a very sort of in-the-moment sort of time. I spend time playing with them on the floor where, it's that issue, it's that disagreement, it's this particular need they have. And that gets me out of the cycling and overthinking of work.
Yeah.
I've become a more intuitive leader,
mm-hmm,
as a result of having time where I just am not going to think about work. I don't want to lose that time with my kids in there. Twins don't allow you time to multitask. So I tell you, my phone is not out when I'm with the kids.
Though.
No, they do. Second thing that I've come to appreciate is we are at risk of handing to our children a democracy and an economy which only works for a few. And it scares me. If you layer on climate change and other big threats, I find myself much more, I have a greater sense of urgency and a sense of accountability to my own kids to make sure that when they're getting ready to take the lead on something, we hand them something that they can still work with.
You got more skin in the game, no
yes,
doubt about
for
it.
Sure.
Well, Don Howard, the President and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. What's on your website that you think listeners might find to be of particular interest?
Two things I'd recommend you look at. We have a link to the results of our community listening sessions, which I think is a really rich trove of information from all of the listening sessions we did around the state. And the second thing I'd look at is the list of our core grantees for our two new initiatives, our Better Careers Initiative and our Fair Work Initiative. They are heroes doing amazing work in our community, and the more folks who know about what they're doing, the better.
Thanks, Don. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.